Some of you may know that I grew up in a family business run by my dad, a grocery store, but it had a butcher shop. It was known far and wide on the southwest side, and I know that quality means something, and that's why we drive 2 hours from northwest Indiana all the way to the northwest side of the city of Chicago to Joseph's Finest Meats at 7101 West Addison Street. Before you go there, you got to be prepared, so I've got a list for you. Do you have a pen? Italian sausage, hot. Italian sausage, mild. Get pork chops, but order them thick. And of course, get some beef too, like bone-in ribeye steaks. Nothing like it. And if you don't know exactly what to get or how to cook it, ask Ben or Sal and tell them John Cass sang. And I'd like to tip my hat to Joseph, the patriarch, the owner, the founder who built this store for his family with his two sons, Ben and Sal. In his mid-90s, he had serious heart surgery and he made a triumphant return. He loves his place, and I do too. And so does anyone who shops there. It's like family. They care about the details. They care about you. Joseph's Finest Meats, 7101 West Addison Street, Chicago. A family tradition since 1977, and a proud sponsor of John Cass News and the Chicago Way podcast. Put this in your mind. The levels of cringe. You're at a backyard barbecue, and there in the corner is a guy doing his white man overbite, dancing, grooving to Taylor Swift. That's one. You know the other that's even worse? James Comey on Twitter telling everybody how much he loves Taylor Swift and how he's a Swiftie. Kid you not.
You see, Taylor Swift and I go way back. I went to my first concert of hers 15 years ago. I've been to a second, and I have helped financially support the attendance of a lot of family members at others. I'm in a family's Swiftie group chat. I know all her music, and I listen to it in my headphones when I cut the grass.
Have you ever seen anything sicker than that? I have. How about Obama using the FBI, Comey's FBI, and the CIA to destroy a presidency and to destroy the American Republic? Because that's what he did. Perhaps more cringeworthy than that, definitely more cringeworthy, is Barack Obama putting it out that Mondami is seeking, Mondami, you know, Zoran Mondami of New York, the socialist or communist mayor and soon to be mayor of New York, that Mondami is seeking his advice and calling him. It's the other way around. Don't be a chump alone, okay? I want you to be the people who listen to this podcast and be sharp. Don't be a mushroom and kept in the dark, okay? Mondami is the prize for Obama. Obama is seeking Mondami's blessing to wash him of all this problems with Comey, John Brennan, the Russia collusion gate, the never-ending leaks, Taylor Swift, be damned, it's Adam Schiff who's his problem. And we're going to talk about all this with Miranda Devine, our guest, award-winning columnist and best-selling author of the New York Post, Laptop from Hell, and other books. And I'm going to have to ask her about this. I want to be polite, but I have to ask her. The New York Post is setting up shop in Los Angeles, a new edition, a California edition in Los Angeles. What about Chicago? What are we, chopped liver? Don't we have enough corruption? We've got a pinheaded, racist mayor who's running the city into the ground. He doesn't know what he's doing. He's suffering from panic attacks. Why isn't the Post covering that? Jeff Carlin is here, executive producer, WGN Radio. And I'm here, John Cass, editor-in-chief of johncassnews.com, where you always get a good cup of Midwestern common sense. Just $50 a year. Join us and see. And where are you with James Comey doing his creepy old white man overbite thing and President Donald Trump tries to bring an end to the war in Ukraine that Obama, it was Obama, let happen? You're on the Chicago Way podcast on WGN Plus.
So this is a guy who lives high on the hog, and he has this Tammany Hall style attitude to power. And it's the Chicago way, absolutely.
Look, the Chicago way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
It's the Chicago way.
The Chicago way. That's the focus.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river. Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
As promised, the great Miranda Devine joins the Chicago Way podcast. Good morning, Miranda.
Good morning, John. Great to be with you.
So I'm so excited you're here because there's so much going on with you, with your new podcast, Air Force One. It's amazing, but also something else has happened. Barack Obama has now, in his search for relevancy, has become something of a guru to your future mayor, Mondami. Is that where he's going to find his peace?
Well, Barack Obama is finding relevance right now, probably not the relevance he'd planned, because he's now fingered as the ringleader, as Donald Trump calls him, of the whole Russiagate, Russia collusion hoax. So, it's very fitting that Mamdani would try to set himself up as some sort of national figure by being mentored by Barack Obama and setting himself against Donald Trump, because, of course, he's too important to battle the mere likes of Andrew Cuomo and the current mayor, Eric Adams.
Before you agreed to do this podcast, I was thinking, what am I going to write for Sunday? I was thinking of having Obama on the psychiatrist's couch complaining that when he calls Mondami, he can sense that Mondami is not really paying attention because he's on the phone.
That is brilliant.
But I'm not going to use it now because I'm a newsman, and that's, you've just said the hard news. The hard news is he is now being fingered as the ringleader, and his place in history is being adjusted. I don't think he'll ever recover from this, no matter what happens to him. His legacy is broken.
I totally agree. And, you know, if you look on X, people are talking about Obama as someone this morning was saying, he's the villain that we always said Nixon was. He seems also desperate to inject himself into current Democrat events, like because obviously the Democrats are missing a leader. So he's anointing himself as that. So he's done a tweet last night or this morning saying, oh, congratulations to the Texan Democrats for their leadership on, you know, this gerrymandering issue. And it's like, what are you talking about? All they did was leave, you know, abandon their jobs and their responsibilities and leave the state.
And go to the most gerrymandered state in the union. So, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, we were talking about that John and I one-on-one last week, and just how just the hypocrisy was just dripping from it. And I couldn't get my head around it. And Miranda, thanks for joining us, and congrats on the podcast. And I think it's Pod Force One. I know John called it Air Force One.
Oh, I'm sorry. What did I call it?
Air Force One. But anyway.
Yeah, everybody does.
That's the gimmick, but I love it.
Pod Force One.
You've been rolling with it now, and we were talking a minute ago, but some of the troubles, tough parts are, you know, keeping it fresh and hot, but you've got some really good guests on it, obviously the president, and you and I were talking about Sean Duffy. He was ripping apart Buttigieg this week, and he didn't have anything really nice to say about the guy, right?
Well, you know, Duffy's a pretty sort of pleasant Midwesterner guy.
Sure.
So he wasn't sort of ripping Buttigieg, but he did in by proxy by just giving us a litany of the disasters in Buttigieg's reign. And that included just not caring and not doing anything about these safety issues that keep on popping up in like
you know, where they're using, I think, copper wire because it's such so old, and then it comes apart and they've got to do these jerry-built sort of patches, and you know, the software is antiquated. Then the DEI stuff that he instituted, where, you know, air traffic controllers, they lowered the standards for entry to air traffic controller school, and God knows the ripple effect of that, sending the morale of these elite, you know, brainiacs who have got so many lives in their hands every day, their morale just plummeting, because they're now, instead of being with peers, they're with these, you know, subpar people that haven't really passed muster to get that job. And then other things like Buttigieg was obsessed with this concept of racist roads and racist bridges. And, you know, instead of building bridges, building roads, repairing the ones that are crumbling, he wanted to rip out these roads that he claimed were racist. So appropriately, Sean Duffy is turns up his nose at all that and is just doing the Trumpian thing, which is to build and fix things and get things working.
It's the hallmark of the left right now, and we've seen it here in Chicago so much. But they don't do the basic things. They don't do the things that need to get done. They just focus on the fringe things. And Mindami's already doing it, like you said. I mean, he's looking at the national story, trying to become a national voice. And New York's rife with issues that need to be touched on, and he's just overlooking all of that, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, this thing that he's clinging to about having, you know, state-owned shops, stores, you know. And like, that is not something that New Yorkers are crying out for. What they're crying out for is law and order, you know, clean streets, being able to catch the subway again, which, you know, half the people I know won't, especially women, don't want to go on the subway because, apart from, you know, you might get pushed onto the tracks. You've also just got homeless, crazy people wandering around there, defecating in front of you, picking fights, killing people. It's not fun. So, you know, that's what the mayor, a good mayor, should be doing. And Eric Adams is not great at all, but he's a big improvement on de Blasio. And Mamdani is going back. I mean, he makes de Blasio look like Giuliani.
I'm sorry, I shouldn't laugh, but because it's a great city, but it's true. He is, I really can't, it's hard to put your arms around what he's doing because it's so grotesque. However, on your podcast, Pod Force One,
nailed it.
I'd like to make the comment that Miranda Devine has always seemed to me to be quite approachable as a character in the podcast world. You're not catty. There's nothing catty about you. You're very welcoming, and people want to hear you because you're not playing games. Is this a function of your long time in the tabloid and the newspaper business? How do you keep it simple?
You're right. I mean, the whole point is I'm not, it's not a gotcha situation. And, you know, I can do gotchas because, as you say, tabloid, you're always looking for the headline and you're looking for the story and breaking stories when you're interviewing someone. So although I'm not trying to ever gotcha someone, you know, you've always got your eye out for the story. But in this case, that's not the imperative. And, you know, I don't care if there's no, I mean, I do care, but it's not the priority to get breaking news from an interview. And the imperative, I think, in podcasts is to make people comfortable and sort of have it like a conversation between friends, so that people get to know the person that you're interviewing and that they're comfortable with revealing parts about themselves that aren't on public display. You know, not terrible secrets, but just things like when Donald Trump divulged that when he was a child, he played the flute.
Amazing.
Yes, which I thought was so charming. I knew it actually. He had told me once before, but he had musical aptitude. His parents sent him to aptitude testing. He told me, because he was a bit of a reprobate as a small child. You know, he was very, very full of energy, as you can imagine. Right. What he's like now. Imagine what he was like as a child, as a little boy. And so he was rambunctious. That was the word he used. And so his parents sent him off for aptitude testing, and it came back with something that his father was, according to Donald Trump, not altogether thrilled about, which was that he was a musical genius. And his father couldn't see that working, particularly being particularly useful on the construction site. But his mother obviously thought it was lovely, and so she decided to get him flute lessons. And he sort of wryly said, "I wasn't very good."
Well, I don't know, Jeff, were you a woodwind player? I kind of think you may have been a woodwind.
No, I was a violinist.
I
was a violin, so.
Big,
I had
burly Jeff.
That's right. Yeah. I wanted to, you know, be able to take my fiddle down to the pier if I needed money. But so Miranda, I mean, I want to get back to the Obama stuff too, because I mean that.
Oh,
the irony is there is just, it's palpable. But you guys both kind of hit this thing. I mean, the comparison to, you know, Richard Nixon is the big boogeyman of U.S. politics in the 20th century, and if you compare the two things, it's just baffling. And John and I were talking about this interview from December of 2016 and how Obama was essentially laying out the groundwork for why he was alluding to that Trump was a tool of the Russians. And it was after the fact. I mean, that's the thing. He's such a bigger threat to, you know, what the machinations of being elected and getting into office and having your agenda, you know, being voted on and done. Do you think we'll ever get to a point where people will actually see that there's this direct nexus between, you know, Richard Nixon and an Obama type in character?
Well, that's interesting. I think that Barack Obama makes Nixon look saintly.
Yes.
You know, when you look back now, the scandal of Watergate was just a pinprick compared to the scandal of Russiagate. There's no comparison. And, you know, Nixon sort of did the right thing by falling on his sword. I mean, he knew that he didn't have the support of his fellow Republicans in the Senate, so I guess he didn't have much of a choice. But still, he sort of tried. He was still behaving like an old school person who abides by the rules, even though he'd, you know, been involved in this burglary and dirty trick. But it was just a political dirty trick, really, compared to what Obama directed his and, you know, perverted the course of justice, having his top national security officials just besmirch the CIA and the FBI and NSA, et cetera, by signing off on bogus intelligence that they knew was not true. The Steele dossier, they all knew was ridiculous. And when John Brennan, at Obama's direction, was cooking up this fake intelligence assessment that had to be rushed through before the transition in sort of record time in a few weeks after the election, to pretend that Donald Trump only won that 2016 election because Vladimir Putin put his finger on the scale. So when that was happening, John Brennan forced the CIA analysts, who against their great objections, to include the Steele dossier in the assessment that he was cooking up, and not just in the as an appendix, which he keeps on saying, "Oh, it's just an appendix," but in the body of the report. And the Steele dossier, as the these top experts at the CIA, top Moscow experts, kept telling John Brennan, it will discredit the entire assessment if we include it, and it sure did. And it was all they had, that's why they kept it classified for so long, so you couldn't see how threadbare the reasoning was. And you just saw the Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, just released a set of emails that she declassified between John Clapper, her predecessor under Obama.
You wrote a column on this, yes.
Yeah. And it's just mind-boggling how stupid Clapper is. He's saying, oh, you know.
Team sport.
Yeah, because Admiral Rogers, Mike Rogers, was pushing back and saying, look, my team, my people are not comfortable with signing off on this. It's too rushed. They haven't had a chance to look at their underlying intelligence. You're not letting them look at it. You know, I'm not going to allow this to have the NSA name on it unless I see the intelligence. And Clapper goes, sorry, not negotiable. We can't. We need to do it in this compressed time frame. No, they didn't. It was just to satisfy Obama. And, you know, this is a team sport, you know, dodging up intelligence. And let's look at it in the spirit of this is our story and we're sticking to it. He as much as admitted that it was all BS.
In terms of the comparison, if you forgive me both, is that Nixon will be read long from now as a genius of statecraft.
Yeah.
Where Obama, but he stepped down rather than fight because he didn't want to hurt the country. Because Nixon knew he may have had the right on his side, but he didn't have the politics on his side. And that would destroy rip the country apart. The difference to me is that Barack Obama, and I've known him for how long, Jeff? So long? I've seen him.
Yes.
I've seen him in the chrysalis phase, coming out of his cocoon and drying on a branch. And I've seen the rest of it with the media fanning him, you know, to life. But through all that time, I never thought of him as a man who would actively rip the country apart. But that's what he's done. That's what he did. He put his own power above that of the country and almost ripped us apart. And I can't forgive that. I won't.
No. No, I don't think anyone should. I mean, the fact that racial relations were much worse at the end of his 8 years than they were at the beginning is a real, I think, the worst indictment of him, because he fanned racial tensions in a country that had proven that it was not racist by electing him in the first place.
Twice, yeah.
Twice, exactly. And you know, it was the most harmonious time before he was elected, and then he had to concoct these, you know, fake anti-police. You know, he went along with all of that, you know, that police were racist. That was where the seeds of George Floyd and the racial division that's torn apart this country and that we saw vividly in 2020 during those riots.
You know, his mentor, William Ayers, the terrorist of Chicago, was the same man who helped raise one of the Soros prosecutors, Chesa Boudin.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
And that's why I've referred to them, Jeff and I, when we talk about this, I refer to them as Boudin was raised by wolves, because the other half of that wolf pairing is Bernadine Dorn, the other terrorist, in my view, who was part of that whole Weather Underground and violence and police. New York, a New York security officer was killed.
That's right.
As a result of what they'd done. And that's Obama for you.
And how did Obama get tied up with him? What was the genesis of that, and how important was he to Obama's rise? Did he write his book, for instance?
This, you know, I think he was with Obama from the beginning. From the beginning, as he emerged from the egg and was introduced to the political intelligentsia of Chicago, and the left wing in the Hyde Park, the same place where a woman named Toni Preckwinkle, that we call Boss Toni, who's up for re-election now, she's now the chairman of the Democratic Party in Cook County. And Toni had been part of that group with Soros and Kimberly Fox, her state's attorney, to reduce the number of prisoners in the Cook County jail. And basically all of Chicago has gone to hell since the Soros prosecutors took hold here. And I don't think the city's ever recovered, because you can have all sorts of speeches you want, but if people are terrified, if, you know, black and brown women who are the poorest among us are terrified to be on the L, that's the only way they can get to and from work. And they're terrified to do that. And there was Ayers and there was Obama as part of that whole cabal. And this is the Chicago left.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's the poison. We can blame Chicago.
it's a Chicago way. That's for sure.
Yeah.
They were neighbors. How you doing?
With over three decades of serving up streetwise insight and local perspective on Page Two, the voice of John Cass has a home at johncassnews.com.
There's a new sheriff in town.
This will truly be the golden age of America. That's what we have to have.
But as he settles in, can you deal with the hysteria, the meltdowns, the constant whining?
I don't know what to do.
You know what you need? You need a good cup of common sense.
It's just common sense.
Like the kind of common sense you get when you subscribe to John Cass News. News.com. I'm John Cass, 40 years a journalist in Chicago.
The Chicago way.
I opened this website, John Cass News, so that you could have a decent cup of common sense.
This great country of ours was built on its entrepreneurial spirit.
It's time that you join the frontier of independent journalism at johncassnews.com.
Subscribe today to get access to great columns from John Cass, Dan Proft, and others. Don't be a chum alone and subscribe at johncassnews.com.
Miranda disappoints me, though. I'm sorry, Miranda. You had a beautiful tweet the other day where you're congratulating, and rightly so, the New York Post's new editions of the West Coast edition, right?
Yes, that's right. The California Post.
And I'm thinking, that's very nice. And I'm glad that you skipped me, because, you know, I'm a competitor here in Chicago, but but New York Post forgets Chicago, because we have no newspapers here now.
Oh, gosh. Isn't that terrible? The Chicago Sun-Times used to be wonderful.
Yeah. It was gutsy and it was brash. It was everything that a newspaper was supposed to be.
Yeah.
When your father ran it.
Well, the thing is, Rupert Murdoch lives in California, so I think he saw vividly that there was a niche in the market that needed filling.
Well, I can tell you that the Los Angeles Times is not the newspaper that California needs, so that should be interesting.
we wouldn't have much for a Page Six too, and that's, you know, that's their bread and butter sometimes. So
Jeff, you would be a natural Page Six here.
Yeah,
you could do all the you know, who was seen at whatever restaurants they go to, and you could do that.
Yeah,
you could see like various starlets going into Jimmy Choo, if there is such a place.
Yeah, except thanks to the Summer of Love, as you call it, there isn't a lot of those high-end places anymore that are just, you know, easy access, and they've all pretty much pulled out of the Mag Mile, which has become almost a ghost town at times because of its policies. And it's there's going to be more of the same, because our mayor is already has a head start on Mindami in New York, and it sounds like Mindami's even been looking up somehow to our mayor, which I don't understand. Do you, Miranda, in New York, I mean, do people draw the connection between our mayor here, Brenda Johnson, and the candidate for mayor?
Well, only in that they're equally awful. And also, you would assume that these mayors of very blue cities that are going to rack and ruin, and I would include the Washington, D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser, they all stick together. Karen Bass in L.A., you know, they're all birds of a feather and somehow pull off, you know, winning elections, even though it should be obvious to every voter where your city is going to go. And New York's already bad enough. You know, it's just Adams has just been holding it together barely. But you know, it's also a sanctuary city, so we have had this inundation of illegal migrants, and that was supposed to be relieved when Donald Trump closed the border and started deporting. I think 1 million people have left already, but it hasn't. I mean, one of the hotels in Midtown near our office, the Row Hotel, used to be a lovely 4-star hotel for tourists, right in, you know, near Times Square and Broadway. And the cops call it Cartel Row for obvious reasons. And it has been just maintaining its terrible ambience, where New Yorkers can't walk past easily because the denizens all act like it's their territory and, you know, not very pleasant, and there's all sorts of crime that emanates from there. But they're being moved now after some outcry, but they're being moved to a homeless shelter in the Bronx, displacing Americans in the homeless shelter and just causing mayhem there. So that's all Adams is doing. He's sort of moving around the deck chairs on the Titanic. And things are a bit better under him, and I don't think, I mean, of all of the candidates, apart from Curtis Sliwa, the Republican, who doesn't have much of a shot, I don't think, I mean, Adams would be the safest bet, and everybody hates Cuomo, but really anybody but Mamdani.
This is just an amazing kettle of fish, right?
Mm.
I can't put my head around it that the capital of capitalism would bring such a person to the forefront. And I think, well, I guess Obama can accept all the credit for that if he wants, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, Obama's sort of people, you know, his staffers, people like David Axelrod and John Favreau and Dan Pfeiffer, who do that podcast bro thing,
right.
they're all helping Mamdani. They all think he's wonderful. They think he's the second coming of Obama because I guess they see how destructive he is. And they're also helping him polish off his rough edges. So his rough edges mainly being his true beliefs and that he's expressed very freely in the past about defunding the police and so on. And he's now pretending that, oh, he's, you know, he really is a great supporter of the police. He turned up at that policeman's funeral the other day, just so disgustingly hypocritical. But that's the way you win office. And voters, Democrat voters anyway, seem to have the memories of goldfish.
The only way that the goldfish can eat is if it gets food from the hand of a journalist.
Yes.
And the journalists feed the goldfish of New York. But why have we not understood, or maybe some of us, I know you have understood this, but I don't think most people have understood it, that the relationship between the Marxist hard left, the universities, and the media, or what we call the legacy media, is a iron triangle, and we're trapped inside it. Why don't we get it?
That's a good way of putting it, the iron triangle, because you're right. You just look at this Russiagate hoax. It would not have been got off the ground if there hadn't been these august media institutions like the New York Times and the Washington Post perfectly happy to go along with it, to in fact enhance it and beat it up and turn it into this glowing narrative. They're very talented at it, to fool their readers. And remember, their readers included members of the Trump administration, members of Trump's first cabinet. And I'm sure that doubt was sowed in their minds because every morning they're reading the Washington Post, it flops on their doorstep, they read it, they believe it, and they start to think that their boss is crooked and in the thrall of Vladimir Putin. And so even if they don't fully believe it, it's enough in the back of their mind that they're cautious. And therefore, what do? They ally with the deep state to put boundaries around Donald Trump and to make sure, because I guess they're patriots and institutionalists. I'm not talking about bad people. I'm just talking about, I guess, former Bush administration people and just people who are institutionalists, probably good people, people that I admired. Yeah. But I scratch my head about now as we're looking back about why they allowed things to go on under their noses. And it suddenly hit me the other night that they probably half believed that maybe what the Washington Post was telling them was true, that Trump was all these awful things and a Russia puppet.
I'm reminded that my brother, Nick, who is now he wanted to talk to you, but I guess now he can't because he's busy working with Tulsi and the Director of National Intelligence.
Oh, good. Great.
But he's out of retirement. But he would tell me that there is no group that is better at manipulating the press than the deep state.
Mm.
And I was thinking of that as you were talking about Trump's first administration and the effects of all that propaganda upon the people. And if you think of an administration like a giant army, it's not only the generals who are affected by propaganda, it's the privates, everybody.
Yes, you're right. And then it becomes a sort of self-fulfilling, delusion. And they're all in on it and they all feel themselves virtuous when they put obstacles in the path of the president. And then they get patted on the back. And, you know, you say that the deep state is good at manipulating journalists. I totally agree. And I think what has happened is, on the one hand, you've got the deep state, aka CIA, FBI operatives, who actually work inside these media companies. So we saw that with the Twitter files, when there were so many of these deep staters crawling around Twitter that they had their own private Slack chat to talk to each other. And you had the FBI's chief lawyer, his general counsel, James Baker, who was parachuted into Twitter 6 months before the election so that he could manipulate and control the narrative and make sure that it was favorable to Joe Biden and unfavorable to Donald Trump. And so, of course, when our laptop story falls in their lap, James Baker, you see in the Twitter files, was prominently advising that Twitter shut us down, which they did, and censor the story and lock our account. And that was against objections, mild enough, but objections still, from the guy who was the chief censor of Twitter at the time, Yoel Roth, who we all castigated. And now I realize unfairly, because he kept on saying, well, I can't see that the New York Post has actually broken any laws, any rules of ours. They haven't violated our hacking violations. And James Baker, the big lawyer, he's like, no, I think they have. And so everyone bowed to him. So that was what was happening. These people, because of their former august positions in these great, once great institutions,
right,
they carry a lot of weight. Their word is listened to by journalists, many who would be, now a new generation, wet around, the ears, and just very impressed by getting a phone call from some CIA operative who's telling them secret things that their editors are going to put on the front page. Who are they to question the bona fides of the information? If the CIA is telling them or the FBI is telling them, well, and everybody knows that Donald Trump's a bad guy, so actually I'm doing the right thing here. So I think that's what happened. They just threw journalistic standards out the door because they felt they were being virtuous and they were so incredibly flattered that the deep state was talking to them.
You're right. The web we weave, it's, if it's got its fingers in everything. And it's this, the whole idea of the unnamed sources or people believing, oh, well, so-and-so, I've got to know a guy kind of thing. And we just run with it. And the users, the end users, the people who take the media in, I hope, especially with the rise of AI being so easy to manipulate things, people are even more skeptical about reading and seeing things and believing what they see. I hope, especially younger generations being so a part of it, you know, being a part of their entire being, see that their stuff isn't real and be like, well, I can't believe anything now. I really have to have real evidence. You know, you'd like to think that's the way we go. We learn from our mistakes, but, you know, time will tell on that front.
Yeah. And I agree. I think that younger people especially will be more cynical, but journalists, we were always supposed to be skeptical of everything. So mm-hmm. I don't know what's gone wrong there, other than I think that they now see themselves and are taught to see themselves at journalism school as activists and propagandists, really.
Sure. That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's it, Miranda. You've got it, because all journalists, at least of the group that you and I were part of, or I was part of, and you're still part of, these newspapers had also an officer, an editor, diversity and inclusion editor. And we all had to go. I was asked to go to a diversity and inclusion session. And one of the editors came up to me and said, please don't say anything. Please don't say anything. Please. She was lovely. I mean, she's one of my best friends, Kristen McQuarrie. She's like, please, you're going to get yourself in trouble. Say nothing. Say nothing. And we're doing the Zoom call with the editor. And I'm like the editor of diversity, which is like a total Marxist struggle session. I was waiting for them to tell me, should I cut my parents' head off? You know, when we get to the point, yes. Are we in Laos now or Cambodia? And she broke in. She just broke in and said, hey, John, I got something that we have to talk about. And she got me out of the meeting.
Kristen McQuarrie is a saint.
She's a saint. But that's the kind of pressure that the corporate media put itself under. To have these people indoctrinaire, driving it again and again and again, all the way, 1619 Project, all that nonsense coming through. Gosh, I don't have an answer for it, except to read novels, everyone. Just read novels.
Yes. Yes. What a good piece of advice that is. I totally agree. And in fact, Matt Taibbi and Walter Kern have been doing this podcast once a week where they just go through, they've done a lot of science fiction, which is I love, but they're just going through classic novels and some obscure ones.
I've got to listen to this.
And it's just wonderful.
I'll never get anything done then if I listen to them.
It's only half an hour a week. You can listen to it on a Saturday or maybe it's a little longer, but they do it very well, and they just got a great synergy together, and they pull apart, Candide or... interesting. Wonderful. And they bring it back to current day themes, which is, and they say they don't choose the books for, you know, to fit the news, but somehow there is always a theme that does resonate. So there is so much wisdom in those classic novels and in the past. I think it will help give us guideposts for the future in this very bizarre environment that we're in, where, as you say, nobody really can trust anything, even you can't trust your own eyes with AI. I think that's kind of dangerous. You need to have something you can trust, some source of information. So look at the past to give us guidance for the future. Look at these wonderful novels.
He who controls the past controls the future.
Exactly.
George Orwell.
Exactly.
And that is why we love Miranda Devine.
Yeah, definitely.
But Miranda, Jeff has one more question for you.
we're talking about essentially trusting our gut. And so one of the things we love to do in the Chicago way here is always to get a recommendation. What's Miranda's, go-to meal? She's finished the column, column's done, it's in, deadline's met. you're going to go and grab a meal after New York. What do you do? Where is the place that makes you feel, you know, at home, or at least makes you feel relaxed? You go and grab something real nice bite to eat.
Well, there's a lovely restaurant that's near work, and it's called Bar Central, and it's in a brownstone, and it's sort of the Broadway crowd go there. And I was introduced to it when I first came to New York in 2019 by our Broadway writer, Johnny Olazinski, wonderful guy. And he took me on a night on the town, and we started off at Bar Central. And it's really a bar, but you can sit at the bar and get a bowl of their special pasta of the day. And it's always delicious. You never really have to ask what it is. And it's just, you know, just a perfect little morsel. Have it with a nice glass of wine and good chat. And there's always a clever barman there to chat to. And it's interesting because if you go there between, like, when the Broadway crowd leaves and goes to see the show, you'll just be able to get a seat without booking. Then as the Broadway crowd trickles in, you'll get some Broadway stars who I don't necessarily recognize, but Johnny does. And they might start singing, or it just gives a real buzz and interest. And you just feel like you're really in the heart of New York, which you are.
That sounds wonderful.
That does sound wonderful. It sounds like a Frank Capra movie, but it's a real, real thing.
Well, they often have movies like that, Frank Capra movies, on a little black and white television above the bar. They just play old movies, which just gives it a nice atmosphere.
That's perfect. We'll see you there.
Well, Miranda, I don't know how you do this. Now I know you have work to do, and so do I, and so does Jeff. But I do have to ask you, the change the podcast format, how has that affected your constant column writing? Because you write, what, 4 a week or 3 a week?
No, I write 2 columns a week, but I do maybe, you know, 1 or 2 other news stories, or however, you know, whatever comes up. Right. So I wrote one yesterday about the wonderful Scott Bessent, Treasury Secretary.
Oh, yeah.
Paying a visit to the IRS because, of course, it's leaderless again after Billy Long, the IRS commissioner, who'd only been in there a few weeks, was ousted by the president for unknown reasons. But he's been given a wonderful new job as ambassador of Iceland, so obviously there's no bad blood there. Scott Bessent is now acting IRS commissioner on top of all his other jobs, which seems to be what Donald Trump likes to do, give a busy person a job and you know they'll do it well. So he went to the IRS for the first time since becoming acting commissioner, and who did he bring with him but the 2 IRS whistleblowers, Gary Shapley and Joe Ziegler, who blew the lid off the Hunter Biden investigation that was being obstructed and slow-walked by DOJ deep state operatives. And they had a terrible time, you know, were retaliated against by the IRS, et cetera. And Scott Bessent made them senior advisors to him, working on reform and integrity in the IRS. So Scott Bessent decided when he made his first visit to the IRS as acting commissioner that he would bring along with him these 2 men, valiant men, putting the fear of God into any bad guys still left at the IRS, and sending a really powerful message to the troops there that he means business, that he's hands-on, he's intent on reform and integrity. And so no deep state resistance will be left uncovered by these 2 bulldogs who, before they were whistleblowers, they were the best investigators the IRS had. And I mean, world class. They were tracking down tax fraud all over the world. Gary Shapley was a supervisor. He was in charge of this task force that was, involved a whole lot of other countries in the Five Eyes. So they are superstar investigators, and they can ferret out moles and bad guys wherever they go. So maybe when they're finished with the IRS, they can be put into the FBI and the CIA, et cetera, as Donald Trump's personal mole hunters.
I don't know what to say. That's a I'm sorry I missed that story because
no, it only happened late last night. It's only,
as of this recording, it's this morning. So, well, Miranda, we've taken a ton of your time, and I always appreciate picking your brain and having you come on and join us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I love reading you, John, and very honored to be asked on the show.
Thank you, Miranda. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Love to talk to you.
For Miranda Devine, who is the inspiration behind Sunday's column on Obama as Nixon. For Jeff Carlin, executive producer, WGN Radio, my friend, and friend of Kat's Baker Pies. I'm still waiting for my pie. And me, John Cass, editor-in-chief of John Cass News. Join us so you can pour your own cup of good Midwestern common sense. Join us again next time, won't you? On the Chicago Way podcast on WGN+.